Lafayette Frederick. Dr. Frederick received his doctorate from Washington State University, a graduate of Tuskegee University and the University of Rhode Island. He is a professor emeritus at the Department of Plant Pathology of Howard University. As an African-American scientist, Dr. Frederick had to break significant barriers to end up where he is today. In 1958, he was responsible for integrating the Association of Southeastern Biologists meeting, which had not allowed its African-American members to attend. Since his days at Southern, he has worked to get black students excited about making new discoveries, an effort that includes taking students to scientific conferences. In 1991, the American Association for the Advancement of Science recognized his tireless efforts in guiding young black scientists by presenting him with a Mentor Award for Lifetime Achievement. Please welcome Lafayette Frederick, who will speak on A Minority Plant Pathologist, Reflections and Suggestions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's I certainly appreciate the the invitation to come and to be a participant in this particular session, and to talk about some of the experiences that I've had as a minority attempting to become a productive scholar and attempting to also provide a pathway for other students to follow into professions that perhaps they might not otherwise have had an interest in. So I shall talk about my early educational experiences, some of the problems and challenges along the way towards becoming a scientist, and some of the reflections on efforts made in order to increase, to some extent at least, the minority pool that's in the field of the botanical sciences, and most notably, of course, in the field of plant pathology. In making this presentation, I will have to apologize for a lot of personal references, but I think I have to do that in order to indicate the kinds of problems that were faced in attempting to become a productive scholar in an academic field such as this. My first attendance at an annual meeting of this society, as well as of the Mycological Society of America and the Botanical Society of America, was in 1949. At that time, most of the botanical societies and some of the zoology-affiliated societies met under the umbrella of AAAS during the Christmas season, and I'm sure many of you in the audience recall those days. That year, the meeting was held in New York City. I was a second-year graduate student at what was then Rhode Island State College, now University of Rhode Island, and was under the tutelage of a Dr. Frank L. Howard, who was a plant pathologist, mycologist, and Vernon Cheadle, who was the dean of the graduate school and the head of botany, a plant anatomist at the University of Rhode Island. I joined the society at that time. It was 1949. And except for a 3 or 4 year gap in the 50s, I've maintained a continued membership. My first opportunity to have a paper presented at an annual meeting was in 1950. That year, the annual meeting was held in Memphis, Tennessee. I submitted an abstract, but couldn't attend the meeting, first because I had just moved to Washington State College after receiving the master's degree from Rhode Island State College and had begun a PhD program in the plant pathology department at WSU, what's now WSU. However, even if I had been available, I could not have presented the paper myself because rigid segregation policies in Memphis at that time would have denied me the opportunity to attend and present a paper in person. My master's degree mentor, Dr. Frank Howard, presented the paper for me. Relatively few persons of color, men or women, have followed a path that has led to a professional life as a plant pathologist, mycologist, or in any particular area of botany. Now, we can ask, why has this been the case? Well, there are several reasons. Traditionally, there have been few opportunities for any interest to develop in these fields. They have been largely unknown fields of endeavor, and there have been few, if any, role models. Few programs at colleges, universities, where the best potential group of prospects were available or offered no opportunities for training in these fields. So then there has been limited or no exposure to these fields in the places where heretofore most black students receive their undergraduate educational training. Also, in the relatively rare instances where an interest might have emerged, potential prospects were discouraged from entering these fields and were advised that few, if any, opportunities for viable professional careers were available. Additionally, persons attempting to break through barriers for training, employment, and research were commonly advised and were commonly not welcomed with open arms by professional societies. So there has been a dearth of persons of color entering the fields of plant pathology, mycology, and botany. The first and still the best known botanist who was black was George Washington Carver. During the early stages of his career, he was known in his community as the plant doctor. Of course, he is better known in modern times as the peanut wizard. Yet Dr. Carver was also a mycologist, published mycological articles with his professor and colleague at Iowa State College, collected numerous fungal specimens in Alabama and sent them to Everhart in Philadelphia, and that resulted in three or four species being named for him. The next person of color to become a mycologist was Charles Parker. He received a master's degree in botany from Washington State College and later a PhD degree from Pennsylvania State College, where he specialized in mushroom systematics. For nearly 25 years, he was chairman of the botany department at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and Howard University is the only predominantly black college or university that has had a botany department. The journey for me, in a sense, began in a small rural community near Fry's Point, Mississippi. The community had the rather quaint name of Dog Bog. It's not on anybody's map, but if you travel one of the county highways from Clarksdale, Mississippi, to Fry's Point in Coahoma County, the Delta area of Mississippi, you will find the name on a road, Dog Bog Road. My family left Mississippi when I was about 1 year old and moved to southeast Missouri. My father and mother both had high school equivalent education, and both were school teachers. At that time, there were no publicly supported schools of any level, elementary or high school, for blacks in Mississippi, and any elementary school programs that were available, and any elementary school programs that were available, were held in churches. Salary support for black teachers was in the form of special contributions, money or produce, from families who wanted their children to have an education. They would ask any person that presumably was trained, that had at least nearly a high school or eighth grade education, to please open the school and teach. Textbooks, if there were any, had to be bought by the parents. My father was interested in having his children receive their education in a state where textbooks were free and where there were public support, and where there was public support for school buildings for blacks and salary for teachers. The closest state was Missouri, so we moved there when I was nearly 1 year old. My education began in a one-room school. My father was a teacher as well as a sharecropper. When time came to plow and plant the fields, my mother served as a teacher in the school. The lower part of Southeast Missouri was cotton country. As a result, we had a split 8 to 9 month school session. The school session began around the first week of July when the cotton chopping season was over. And this session ended around the first week in September when the cotton picking season began. The cotton picking season ended by the first week of November and the school session resumed. This split session school year was for all schools, black and white, in that part of Southeast Missouri. Although school books were free, black students only received used textbooks. Each year, when new books were bought for the white elementary schools, the old books were sent to the black schools. After skipping a couple of grades, I graduated from elementary school and entered the summer part of the school year at the high school in the nearest town, about 5 miles from home. At that time, the town only had a 2-year high school for blacks. No transportation was provided for the dozen or so students from our community who wanted to attend the high school. To arrange transportation, several families agreed to pay a man who had put seats in a 1.5-ton truck around $3 a month per child to transport them to the high school. In order to be picked up, we had to walk to a common location. This high school had 2 teachers. 5 courses were taught, namely English, history, civics, general science, and mathematics. The science class had no equipment and no laboratory. When I completed the 10th grade at this school and graduated, I entered the 11th grade in a small, newly built 4-year high school in a neighboring town about 12 miles from home. This was the only 4-year high school for blacks in the 3 counties that make up the lower part of Southeast Missouri. By that time, the school system had begun to provide transportation for black students in the surrounding countryside, and we no longer had to gather at a central location. We would be picked up near where we lived. Although the high school teachers were excellent, facilities were meager. Courses in chemistry and physics were not offered. There was no foreign language course. Only 1 microscope was available in the biology class, and there was no organized laboratory. I graduated from high school, therefore, without taking a course in chemistry, physics, a foreign language, or a standard biology course. I applied and was admitted to Tuskegee Institute. However, the weekend that I was to leave for Tuskegee, my father gave me the sad news that he was unable to arrange for the $200 that I needed for registration. A man whose farm we had previously lived on had promised my father that he would provide him with $200 in order for me to have the money to register. But then on the day that my father was to receive the money, he was told that he was trying to do too much for his children. He said that white parents in the community were not trying to send their children to any college, and he couldn't see the need for him to try to send his. Therefore, I couldn't leave for college. It was the start of the cotton picking season. I reasoned, therefore, that if I picked cotton furiously for 2 weeks, that I could make enough money to pay the registration fees and leave for Tuskegee. Well, I was successful in this endeavor, and after 2 weeks, I left for college. I arrived, however, about 3 or 4 days after the last day for registration for the school term, and I had considerable difficulty persuading the authorities not to send me back home, but to let me stay and enroll for that particular term, even though they said I could not receive credit for that term. At Tuskegee, under the mentoring of my biology teachers, I began to develop an interest in botany as a field of biology. The biology chair was a Dr. Harry Rahm, who had recently been awarded a doctorate degree in botany from Iowa State College. My major was agriculture, with a specialty in floriculture. Insofar as botany as a field was concerned, I was not aware of the scope of the field, had no knowledge of scientific societies, and knew nothing about any scientific journals. The botanical interest that I had developed was in higher plant systematics. This interest was not pursued until 3 years after graduation, when I enrolled as a part-time graduate student in the botany department at the University of Hawaii after discharge from the Navy and while working as an architectural draftsman at a naval air station. There I came under the tutelage of Dr. Harold St. John, who chaired the Department of Botany at the University of Hawaii. I also met two mycologists during this period of study. They were Drs. Donald P. Rogers and Dr. Marion Lohman. My association with Dr. Rogers on the many field trips taken by the botany group during my 2 years as a part-time graduate student and the course that I took from him caused me to develop an interest in mycology. Eventually, I decided to engage in full-time graduate study with the urging of Dr. Rogers, I applied for admission to the master's degree program in botany at Rhode Island State College. Dr. Frank Howard was a mycologist, plant pathologist, with an appointment in the botany department, but with a main responsibility as the director of the plant pathology entomology program in the College of Agriculture. Dr. Vernon Cheadle was chair of the botany department, dean of the graduate school. And if I were to, of course, dedicate this particular presentation to any persons, it would be to Drs. Harry Rahm, Drs. Frank L. Howard, and Dr. Vernon Cheadle. The MS degree was the highest graduate degree offered by Rhode Island State College at that time. I was welcomed cordially by both Drs. Cheadle and Dr. Howard. I was the first black graduate student at Rhode Island State, and in welcoming me, Dr. Cheadle stated that I had an opportunity to become a productive and respected scholar in the field of botany. Throughout my academic career, I have attempted to emulate the teaching style, attention to detail in research and writing, and the work ethic of Dr. Cheadle. At my first meeting with Dr. Howard, he indicated that he accepted me as a graduate student due to the recommendation of Donald Rogers. They had been graduate students under the same professor at the University of Iowa. He advised, quite frankly, that when I completed my study for the degree, that he would have difficulty placing me in a position as a plant pathologist. Studying under the tutelage of Dr. Howard represented my first introduction to the field of plant pathology. I selected an aspect of the Dutch elm disease program ongoing at Rhode Island at that time as my thesis project. Dr. Howard was a rigid taskmaster and an excellent role model to emulate. My master's degree program was successfully completed in 2 years, and I chose of schools that I wanted to enter for the doctorate program, Washington State College, now Washington State University. Again, although I was unique as a graduate student in plant pathology or botany or any of the other fields of science at Washington State, my reception was cordial by both the faculties, staff, and fellow graduate students. My thesis project was on an aspect of the crown gall problem. The only differences in the way I was treated during my 2 years at WSU was in the handling of announcements of job opportunities that would come to the department. I knew full well that I was not going to be offered positions at places like DuPont or many of the agricultural chemical companies or positions in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So job announcements from industry or the federal government or other places like that were never directed my way. I was not concerned by the oversight because I had planned anyway to seek an academic position in a biology department at some one of the black colleges in the South where I could initiate a program in botany and perhaps stimulate other students to consider developing careers in some aspect of the botanical sciences. During my second year at Washington State University, I received notice of my undergraduate botany mentor, Dr. Rahm, who had then gone to Southern University, that there was an opening for a botanist in the biology department at Southern University in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I applied and was offered the position. My academic career began there in 1952. At Southern, the teaching load was heavy. We taught 22-plus clock hours per week. It was minimal equipment for laboratory instruction. Just a table in a room with other colleagues served as the office. There were no botanical journals in the university library and no equipment or supplies for research. The department chairman was forward-looking, however, and encouraged young faculty to strive for a modicum of productivity in spite of the deficiencies. I was asked to plan a botany curriculum for the department and to author with two other colleagues a botany laboratory manual. Within 2 years, I had written the manual and had it published. I sent copies of the manual to botany departments at several major schools, universities, for review and comments. Favorable reviews were received, but with the most interesting comment coming from a department chair at one of the state universities in Louisiana. He said that the manual was surprisingly good. Initially, I tried to establish some contact with the botany department at Louisiana State University, but was rebuffed. A member of the zoology department at LSU that our department chairman knew invited those of us with Sigma Xi memberships to a Sigma Xi lecture at LSU on one occasion. We attended, were very coolly received, and were never invited again. Attending professional meetings like the AIBS sponsored meetings and the AAAS during my first 3 years was just out of the question for me because of personal funds were not available, and certainly funds were not available from the university. An attempt was made by some or several of us to join and attend the meetings of the Louisiana Academy of Science. We attended one meeting 1 year at Loyola University, and a couple of papers were presented by two colleagues. The next year, we were advised that we could not attend further annual meetings, but were given two options. We could submit abstracts and have them read by the president or the secretary at the annual meetings, or we could have a separate meeting on our own at Southern University. I rejected both options by letter and canceled my membership. In 1955, AAAS felt that some progress had been made in race relations and that sort of thing in the South and especially in Atlanta, and had decided to hold this annual meeting for the first time in the South in 20 years in Atlanta. Our APS had its annual meeting that year with AAAS in Atlanta, and I decided to drive over, take two students of mine who were two of the first three botany majors and attend the meetings of AAAS and APS. I arranged for housing in a dormitory at one of the black colleges in the Atlanta University Center. We attended the society sessions at the Conference Hotel and the main sessions at the Civic Auditorium. Only the rooms where sessions were held were rooms available to us. The plenary session and the reception had to be held on the campus of Spelman College, the College for Women in the Atlanta University Center, in order for all registrants to attend. One of the two students who attended with me, O'Neill Ray Collins, who I took to the meetings, went on to graduate study at the University of Iowa and became a well-known mycologist and eventually the chair of the Department of Botany at the University of California, Berkeley. The other student earned a graduate degree in plant pathology at Washington State University, and after military service, developed his own environmental consultant firm in Massachusetts. While at Southern, I organized a biology honors club with the intent to eventually apply for a chapter status in the Phi Sigma Biology Honor Society. However, we discovered that we were ineligible for chapter status since we had no graduate program. Instead, we decided to apply for chapter status in Beta 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 Biology Honor Society. The regional director accepted our invitation to visit the campus and evaluate our qualifications. A recommendation for chapter status was made, and our chapter was installed. At the time of chapter installation, we were informed that chapters in the two southern regions of Tri Beta met annually with the Association of Southeastern Biologists. The next meeting of ASB was to be held at Florida State University. This would have been 1958, and the national president of Tri Beta, who was chairperson of the zoology department at LSU, encouraged us to attend. 4 years earlier, I had become aware of ASB because the annual meeting had been held at LSU. My former botany mentor, Dr. Rahm, and a colleague who was a colleague at Southern University, and a member of the biology faculty and the Carver Research Foundation at Tuskegee, Dr. James Henderson, who had come to Baton Rouge to present a paper. They went out, but they were not allowed to register for the meeting because their presence would have violated the state segregation policies. I made no attempts, therefore, after that, to try to affiliate with ASB. However, now with the invitation to attend, this is 4 years later, with the invitation to attend the Florida State University meeting as a Tri Beta chapter, we decided to participate. 2 faculty members and 4 students registered for the meeting. I arranged with a faculty colleague at All Black Florida A&M University for housing in private homes for the female students and the female faculty member, and for lodging for me and the other male persons accompanying me. We arranged for a lodging on the campus at Florida A&M. Due to our presence at this meeting, the annual banquet normally held by ASB was canceled, and the award ceremony and the president's address were held in an auditorium. Since that year, 1958, a delegation of faculty and students have been in attendance at each annual meeting of ASB. The 25th year celebration of ASB was to have been held at the University of Georgia in 1962. Because the university was going through the throes of integration, the ASB Executive Committee changed its plans to meet there that year and met instead on the new campus of Wake Forest University. 25 years later, the golden anniversary of ASB was held at the University of Georgia. And I was a speaker on this occasion as the immediate past president of ASB. In 1962, I took a position in the biology department at Atlanta University, where I later became chair of the department. Atlanta University was entirely a graduate school that offered MS degrees only at that time. Doctorate programs were initiated a few years later. Colleagues at Atlanta University were not affiliated with the Georgia Academy of Science. My initial inquiry about membership was favorably received, but it took 3 years before an offer was made for membership status. Some years later, I was elected president of the Georgia Academy of Science. While teaching undergraduate students, my primary objective was to see that students in the program that I was asked to initiate were adequately trained to meet the rigorous academic challenges of graduate study any place. Even though facilities and library resources were woefully inadequate at that time, the gap between a weak and a strong academic training program was bridged. Through innovation, imagination, and by striving to be an example to emulate, my colleagues and I challenged the minds of students, improved study attitudes and approaches, instilled confidence in their ability to achieve, enhanced self-motivation, cultivated the desire to become someone, and firmly implanted the notion that they too could excel as well as anyone else. These, in my judgment, were the kinds of ingredients needed, especially at that time, to create the kind of climate that would properly nurture and adequately prepare Black undergraduate students for the challenges of graduate school. These efforts were met with some success, and as I've mentioned, Dr. Collins, who became chair of the Department of Botany, was one of those students. There were at least 8 others who emerged from this undergraduate program that I initiated at Southern University to enter graduate school and achieve with distinction. For each one, including Dr. Collins, the fields that they have specialized in represent areas in which no knowledge of or exposure to prior, which they had no knowledge of or exposure to prior to their freshman year in college. Many of these students, as they would come to Southern University, if they were going to major in science, if they weren't thinking about going into medicine, they thought that they would end up teaching high school science, teaching science at the high school level. That was Dr. Collins' idea. He had no notion that he might go to graduate school, that he might enter a field of mycology, and then he might be the success that he became. Similar successes have been met During several years of teaching at the graduate level, I have had students of average to superior ability enter the graduate program at Atlanta University. Most of these students be regarded as high risk or unworthy of risk by the majority of the nation's graduate schools. They came from accredited, marginally accredited, sometimes unaccredited colleges. By carefully monitoring and nurturing their academic growth during their first year of study, most of these students were brought to a place where they could compete successfully with their peers at graduate institutions. Now, I was always rather careful about, I used a certain strategy in terms of recommending graduate schools for my students. I knew that there were a number of graduate programs, it's a number of universities that were minority unfriendly. And as a consequence, I would not suggest these schools as schools that students of mine would apply to and to undertake graduate work. I also knew that there were some schools that might have been minority friendly, but some of these schools had quite a minority, about just two or three. Some of these schools were known to have double standards. They would not require the same quality work of black students who were graduate students in their departments as they would of white students. Now, the kinds of experiences noted have enabled me to develop a broader and deeper appreciation for the plight of minority students in general and black students in particular as they face the matter of graduate education. First, in my view, is the consideration of the needs of minority undergraduate students as one attempts to inculcate an interest and implement their preparation for graduate study. For most of the students that I have taught as undergraduate students, graduate school was commonly unheard of or was a remote and unattainable academic endeavor. Therefore, for the black undergraduate, there is commonly the initial need to encourage a student to think in terms of undertaking post-baccalaureate study. This need exists for the following reasons. There's a general lack of knowledge about the possibilities of high-order professional advancement and success if graduate study is to be undertaken and completed. This is changing in predominantly black schools, but that has been the case previously. Commonly in the community out of which the students come, there's been no contact with persons holding graduate degrees, particularly the doctorate degree, to serve as role models to emulate. Neither the student nor the student's parents may know the difference between a person called doctor because of the PhD degree or the one called doctor because of the medical degree. It may be that the student has never seen anyone with either degree. Commonly, the student is unaware of the requirements of graduate school or the prospects for financial support. The student is unaware also of the relatively small size of the pool of blacks holding doctorate degrees and the critical need to increase this pool. A colleague of mine, Dr. James Jay, a microbiologist, published a little book back in 1972, in which he listed and had an accounting of all blacks that had received PhD degrees in all of the fields of sciences since the first one received it from around 1872 at Yale University. And up until 1968, there had not been, in all of the fields of science, chemistry, biology, botany, and so on, there hadn't been 600 blacks to receive PhD degrees in those fields. So if it was important then to try to overcome some of those problems in terms of a lack of understanding about the opportunities in graduate school. So in order to do that, I suggested the following, that one should manifest a close personal interest in the student that has exhibited average to outstanding academic promise. In this process of identifying student potential, it is important to consider the student who appears mediocre as well as the student who exhibits occasional flashes of commendable academic promise, but low industry or motivation. These students may be the products of poor high school counseling are low cultural stimulation. And I might say that now, the unfortunate thing is that many of black students in high schools, secondary schools, are not encouraged to go into the science fields or other fields. And they are not encouraged to do that by the counselors, so that many students are not even advised about the opportunities. Person who was dean at Mary Medical College, who received his undergraduate training in New Jersey, he was told by his counselor that he should play baseball. He was a good baseball player. He shouldn't worry about going to college. Play baseball. And that's the kind of information, unfortunately, that a number of counselors are providing. Students who have potential, who, if encouraged, could, of course, enter fields such as these. In beginning graduate courses, these students should, interest should be manifested towards all students of promise, regardless of their discipline or interest. They may be most effective, and one may be most effective, through unofficial counseling. At this stage, the important thing is to get them to begin to think about graduate school. What the student's interest in research and other creative endeavors, that is, you should whet the student's interest in research and other creative endeavors by frequently emphasizing during the product of a course those unexplored areas of knowledge where critical answers to important questions are lacking, and by pointing out to students that the elucidation of these questions await their efforts. It is important to stress the role that they can play in making and answering these questions, in making the new and significant discoveries, in authoring the books that will become landmark contributions to knowledge in their fields. And all of this can be done provided they are properly trained. The point to make is that they are as capable as anyone else. And this is the point that I've attempted to make throughout my academic career as I work with students. One should carefully supervise their program of study, monitor their progress, steer them into combinations of courses, course sequences as a basis of their academic maturity, that they have a chance of successfully managing. This must be done without imposing professorial authority for the student, must be given the opportunity to exercise options and make the ultimate decisions. In these matters, I've attempted to serve as a guide and not as a decision maker. One should give liberally of one's time at the expense, perhaps, of delaying or sometimes denying one's own professional fulfillment. It is important to establish the "I am here primarily to help you" attitude in the professor's relationship with the student. One needs to realize that often for the black student, as well as other principal minorities, the undergraduate experience may represent the first time that anyone has given recognition to the student's self-importance. In the pre-college experiences of many minority students, they have found themselves regarded essentially as nobodies by persons in authority. When given recognition by someone in authority that the student has respect for, a greater feeling of self-pride is engendered, and the student begins to feel that someone of stature has faith in his or her ability to achieve. This can be accomplished by engaging students as participants in one's research program, by taking students to local or professional meetings where they meet other students at comparable levels of development and meet mature scholars in their field. And in this particular regard, this is one of the things that I've attempted to do, that my wife and I, we will tell students, well, we're going to this meeting, we'll take you in the car, it won't cost you anything for transportation, so we'll load the car up and we'll take you to the meetings. And as a consequence, we have done that over the years, taken students as far from, let's say, from Atlanta to Alberta, to Edmonton, Alberta, in order for them to attend meetings. And then one of the interesting experiences in terms of having students present papers where they aren't expected to do well, apparently, black student, was at an ASB meeting where three of the students, one who has become, he just retired as chancellor of Indiana University in New Albany, Indiana, gave papers And one of the members of the society came up to me afterwards and says, you know, these three students gave some of the best papers in this meeting. He says, they were just excellent. He said, they must have had to practice a long, long time to do that well. Because he couldn't believe that students of color could make those kinds of presentations unless they had indeed practiced and practiced and practiced. So we should point out the limited heights to which one may ascend professionally without the graduate degree, and emphasize the fact that when armed with an advanced graduate degree, one's ceiling is unlimited, for the height to which one may rise are determined primarily by the magnitude of one's industry, ambition, and self-determined goals. So, you see, one can certainly come from extremely humble original circumstances, and if given the opportunity, if given the chance, one may achieve, one may ascend to heights of reasonable prominence in one's field, and one can also make an effort to increase by one's effort the opportunities for others to also develop their talents, their skills, and become highly productive scholars in the field. And my effort has been, of course, to strive to bring more of these kinds of persons into the field of mycology, plant pathology, and botany as productive and outstanding scholars. So thank you very much for your attention to these my recount of these experiences that I've had, some of the experiences I've had. There are many others, but time will not permit me to talk about others. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.